Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 211, recorded Monday, August 3rd, 2015. Mark Johnson of Descartes Labs. Triangulation is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door, anywhere in the world, using your smartphone. It's kind of like caller ID for your home. Get $10 off the Ring Video Doorbell when you go to ring.com/triangulation. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions, fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/triangulation. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost, automated investment service that is the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/triangulation to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we take some of the most interesting people in the world and talk to them, often in technology. And I love doing this every Monday. It's a great way to start the week. And I'm glad you're here because Mark Johnson is joining us. Mark is an interesting serial entrepreneur, co-founder of Descartes Labs, which does something mysterious. But he'll explain it all to us. And I'm so glad you're here in studio from New Mexico. Thank you.
I'm so glad to be back in California.
Yeah, thanks. Is that where you started?
Yeah, so I was here. I came out. I grew up in Buffalo, then came to Stanford and studied philosophy, and then I ended up in
the tech world. Philosophy? That's not good preparation.
I'm at Philosophy Geek. That's you know, so I took a year off from Stanford, partially at Stanford's suggestion, and it was a really good idea. It was the mid-90s, and I really found my focus after that. I realized that there are a lot of people in the tech world that didn't study computer science, and
right.
That's okay.
Right.
And I knew whatever I studied, I could go find a job in technology, so I studied what I loved.
Good. Descartes Labs, now I'm understanding that.
Yeah, there's a connection there.
Yeah.
And actually, the real reason is that we were having debates about what the name should be, and I actually got the URL and Twitter handle, and I just closed the debate because you can go on those debates.
Is your motto cogito ergo sum, or...?
Yes.
It is?
No, we don't have one yet, but I mean, we make Descartes jokes all the time.
Oh, I bet you do. So I'm going to go backwards. Usually I start at the beginning. Wait a minute. Let me turn this off. I think I might start backwards here because what Descartes Labs is doing is quite interesting. First of all, this is technology from Los Alamos National Labs.
Yeah. So, I met a group of scientists from Los Alamos National Laboratory last July. So I'd never set foot in New Mexico. They showed me a demo of what this technology could do, is deep learning, artificial intelligence for image and video recognition. And actually, at the time, they showed me a search over 100 million Vine videos over Skype. And
wow.
I had worked at a lot of search companies prior to this, and I was so blown away on the Skype interview. I mean, I was nervous about a bunch of guys on a mesa, what they could possibly do, and I was so impressed, I hopped on a plane to New Mexico a few days later, met them, and realized that this was an amazing group of geniuses. But interestingly, the government has lots of image recognition problems, so the technology had been applied to video and social media, drones, satellite imagery, security cameras, so we had, a lot of demos within the labs, and then, we chose satellite imagery as the first area that we wanted to analyze.
So what you're going to do initially is take satellite images and look for...
So we actually focused... you can see a lot of things from satellite images. You can see...
So you can see everything.
Yeah, well, except I mean, remember, inside. Resolution, right, is really important here. Yeah. That there are satellites that go from 1,000 kilometers to satellites that take it 30 centimeters. So your spatial resolution becomes really important because you can't necessarily see, cars on the freeway with... even 30-meter resolution.
Right.
Cars bigger than that. So the first thing we're looking at is agriculture, though. That it
sure turns, that makes sense.
Yeah, because there's a lot of it growing. Plants don't move.
Right.
That's convenient. And
what kinds of things can you see?
So you can see. So the first project they're doing, it turns out that no one has ever made a map of where all the corn, soy, wheat, et cetera, is growing on the planet in real time. Hmm. People sometimes do this after the fact for small parts of the world, but we don't do this in real time. So not only can you see the corn plants and identify that it's corn and not soy growing, you can also tell how healthy the corn is and try to predict how much corn is going to come out of that acre.
That sounds useful.
It is. You can imagine that.
That sounds very useful.
A lot of people might want to know this, like not just commodities traders, but crop insurance, right? Yeah. If you're thinking about loss forecasting and things like that.
Well, everybody would want to know. Governments. Everybody would want to know.
Absolutely.
Farmers. So is the world completely available? Do you have a complete data set of satellite images?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of three classes of satellites. There's your government-supported satellites. So NASA has Landsat. The Landsat program has been taking pictures since 1972.
Yeah.
They have a wonderful archive.
We see a lot
archive.
Of those on Google Maps, I think.
Yeah, they're you know, it's an incredible archive, not just because of taking a picture of the globe every 16 days with each satellite, but that they have such a long archive that you can do historical analysis. So that's a source. So there's these government satellites. The European Space Agency has the Sentinel program where they've put a few up already. They'll be putting more up. So those are great, great archives. And those are, you know, typically, you know, say 30 meter resolution and above.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Yeah. But
you said in real time. What's in real time?
Well, so another nice thing about plants is they grow slowly, right? in real time for plants is when you're looking
at months.
Sort of,
okay,
a few days, really, okay. You can see things change. I mean, you know, this year we had a very wet June, a very dry July.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's causing some questions about corn yield in the U.S. And,
right.
You know, you can
try
to see
that right
stuff.
Away.
Yeah, you can. Well, you can start to see the change in the plant health.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's really neat. You wouldn't think that that from that height you could see this, but you certainly can. And one of the things that we use is not just the visual bands, but the infrared bands, which turn out to be really useful for that.
I know, because when you take infrared photography, things that are green show up bright white, right?
Yes.
So you can tell the level of greenness, I guess, which would be important for plant health.
Yeah, so, you know,
some of the years are yellowish. They're not going to be as bright. Or
yeah, we're looking at, like, boatloads of satellite imagery to do this. So we're looking at corn yield right now, and I think the figure is something like 100 trillion pixels we had to look at to look over 15 years of imagery.
All right.
So
I just wanted to get what Descartes Lab was. We have gone to the end, but we're going to come back to Descartes Lab because there's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about, artificial intelligence and imaging. Lately, you've seen those weird Google pictures. Everybody's playing with that imaging thing. What are they?
Oh, yeah. The sort of like that trippy thing.
Yeah,
that
it's really trippy.
It's super trippy. I can't watch it for too long.
I think that's most of the interest in it. What's it called?
Deep Dream.
Dream. And you can actually do it, I think, pass your own images to Deep Dream. It's got a web interface. Thank you, Google, for giving me really bad nightmares. So I want to ask you a little bit about this. I mean, obviously this is just a toy, but there is some importance to this. This is an artificial intelligence looking at images, trying to synthesize somehow a way of recognizing what's in those images, right?
I mean, and, you know, the whole point of deep learning is try to simulate, you know, use what we know about the physiology of the brain and how we think the brain works to do this. So if we're right, then those images are, at some level in our head, are what we're seeing.
Now we're getting into philosophy.
We are. I mean, I'm thinking, so, yeah.
Which I like. We're going to take a break. We're going to talk some more. But I want to go back to the beginning, because I mentioned that Mark is a serial entrepreneur. He sold his first startup. Cosmix was your first, yes?
That was not mine, though. I was a mere product manager. I was employee number 12.
Sold to Walmart. PowerSet.
Mm-hmm.
You did that.
I was a product manager there also.
That was sold to a little thing, a company called Microsoft. They renamed it Bing. You worked at Zeit. That was yours. Zeit was yours, yes?
Yeah, so yes.
Twice you sold that.
Sold it twice, which is really weird.
I don't get that, and you're going to explain it.
I'll do what I can. It confuses me, too. But it gives my ratio is awesome, right? So all the startups that I have worked at have sold at some point. And one of them twice. So it means that 120% of the startups I worked at have sold. So good ratio.
Pretty good for a philosophy major, I got to say. You're doing okay. We're going to have a lot of fun. A lot more to talk about in just a second. But first, I want to tell you about my doorbell. You know, I have a great doorbell. In fact, yesterday, it was this morning. I said my daughter was visiting. I said, when did she leave? She left after we went to bed. Lisa pulled out her smartphone, opened the Ring app, and said she left at 10:21. Because Ring is the coolest thing. It's kind of I think they call it caller ID for your house. So I put in the Ring doorbell. It's very easy. I'm not a handyman, but I was able to do this. You can replace a wired doorbell. That's what we have. There's just two wires coming out of the doorframe. You take off the old doorbell. You hook up the Ring doorbell. It will still ring your doorbell inside the house, but it does a lot more. I'll tell you about that in a second. Even if you don't have wiring for a doorbell, you can just, it has adhesive on the back, stick the Ring doorbell there and use it as a doorbell. It's got a one-year lithium-ion battery, easy to recharge using a USB port on the Ring doorbell. But now, let me tell you what that is. First of all, it's a very pleasant chime. I like it. But I can hear that on my smartphone. When that doorbell rings, my phone rings anywhere on the internet. So I know when somebody's at my front door ringing. And then, even better, it's got a lovely wide-angle camera on the front, and I can see who... Stop ringing. Is that you or me?
Yeah,
okay. Oh, okay. I can see who's there, and I can say, accept, and I can talk to them. I can hear them, even when I'm at work. So when the UPS guy comes, I can say, hey, I'm in the shower. Could you just leave it on the front porch? Pretend I signed for it. Oh, it's awesome for that. It also has motion detection, and that's cool. And you can set the motion detection. You can set the range. You can set where it looks. It gives you an actual map of what it's looking at, so you can completely control it. And now it will let me know when somebody comes up to the door, but even if they don't ring the doorbell. You know, it turns out that 95% of home break-ins, this is a safety thing, happen during the day, and almost always they ring your doorbell first just to make sure you're not home. Now we'll have nice,
really?
Clear video of them ringing your doorbell before they break in. It's a wonderful thing. It's easy to use. It's very affordable. In fact, we're going to give you $10 off, making it even more affordable. And look how thoughtful they are. I mean, they've really done it right. Inside the Ring kit, everything you need to install it. There's even a drill bit for the anchors if you need to use them. There's a screwdriver with appropriate bit. That's a level. So you can even have it make sure it's level. They do it right. There's videos that show you how to do this. It works over your Wi-Fi with your smartphone, Android or iOS. The picture quality is superb, I have to say. It really does a great job. I am so happy. And you can have, by the way, multiple Ring doorbells. So you can have them all over the, you know, front door, back door. I could even have a Ring doorbell out front here and have it ring my phone. It really is great. $10 off if you go to ring.com/triangulation. I've tried a number of systems like this. This is easily the best. They just nail it. You know, sometimes... there's a lot of people trying something, but when the company nails it, you go, yeah, that's it. That's the one. This is the one. Ring.com/triangulation. I don't know if my daughter knows that we can tell when she leaves the house. She knows now. Our guest is Mark Johnson. He's with Descartes Labs, which is a very interesting artificial intelligence startup in New Mexico. Using technology that it got from the Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Where we built the bombs.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a name that goes down in history. So I'm just curious, though. You're a philosophy major at Stanford. There is this feeling, I'm sure, at Stanford and certainly everywhere in that area of kind of, in the mid-90s especially, I'm sure, kind of excitement. And there's a buzz. I used to live there in the late 70s, early 80s, and it was there already. I mean, it was because of Apple and IBM was there. They had their hard drive facility there, HP. So did you catch that fever? You came from Buffalo. You go to Stanford. You feel the buzz?
I did. You know, very early on, you know, one of my best friends and mentors is Hugh Deverly, who's an advisor to Descartes Labs. He, a very famous designer who worked on the Mac OS logo and whatnot. At the time, he was at Netscape running design for them. It's just fascinating to, like, have a firsthand view of what's going on. Because you always just run into random people just based on your friends.
And you kind of want to be part of it, don't you?
Yeah. It's,
I know I did.
It sucks you in, but in a really good way. I mean,
right.
because you see so many awesome things happening and you see the companies that are they're moving the world forward and you want to figure out how you can get to be part of that.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. So when I took the year off, I actually worked in PR for a bit. Then I worked as a tester for a little while. Then I went back to the PR firm. And then I went back to school.
Finished, got your degree?
Yes.
Yeah. Not everybody. I didn't. I mean, a lot of us just said, this is too much fun. I'm staying.
Yeah.
Woz did that. Jobs did that. A lot of people did that.
It seemed like, even though there's a lot of stuff going on at the time, I figured it was going to be there when I got out.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, I graduated in 2001, and a lot of my friends ended up going to Peace Corps, law degrees, PhDs, what have you. Whereas I actually was lucky and got a job, but it was a pretty... The year before, I remember this, Trilogy Consulting was giving out BMW Z3s as signing bonuses.
Holy cow.
To Stanford students. The next year, they weren't there. B, it had shrunk from literally the entire campus to just one small square of companies hiring at the time. It was an insane concoction.
That must have scared you a little bit.
Well, you know, it's like all about the long view, right? I think that what was unique about 2001 versus 2008 is that hit the valley hardest, right? This was the epicenter. And, you know, I remember friends like, you know, crying and packing all their stuff in their car and moving back to Kansas City because couldn't make it here anymore because there were no jobs to be had. So it was hard because you saw a lot of friends lose their jobs.
Yeah.
But it's a good reminder also that you can easily get caught up in hype. And I think those corrections are incredibly important to remind us of
that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Irrational exuberance. So did you go to Cosmix right away, or what? When did you join Cosmix?
No, I started off at SAP.
All right.
So that was, being the downturn, it hadn't quite hit SAP. So I, SAP Labs in Palo Alto, at least at the time, was the second largest developer facility outside of Waldorf, Germany. So that was fun. I actually studied German in high school, never thought it was going to be useful, and it turns out it was incredibly useful.
You didn't do any coding. Were you in marketing at the time, or what did you do there?
Yeah, I was a product manager there.
Product manager.
One of my first meetings, oddly enough, was with Enron, who was a really big client. So I was in the HR software division, and they were actually doing some incredibly cool, innovative stuff. Super smart people there. You know, not everybody was a bad egg. In fact, they had attracted a lot of smart people.
Sad to say, it was the top levels, not the rank and file.
Yeah, you know, I'm sad Ken Lay died before he. Got shipped off to jail.
Yeah.
It was a really interesting view into a lot of companies because you got to see how internal processes worked and how they were moving from this world of paper to this world of electronics.
Yeah.
And also, even SAP was going through the transition of the old R3 software, which is something you install on the desktop, to web software.
They were already moving to the cloud.
Well, they were moving to at least a web-based interface because, you know, they used to be programs where you have to run it, you have to send someone to a five-day training to figure out what the heck is going on in it. So, you know, that world was quickly changing. People suddenly wanted the functionality of Rocket Mail or Yahoo Mail or whatever it was back then.
Right.
It was interesting to see that transition.
Yeah. And then when you go to a startup, because that's a big company, it's a very different feeling.
I mean, one of the largest independent software companies in the world.
Right.
And then I went to Sidestep, which was a travel search engine. So you might remember at the early days, it was this pop-out bar in your browser.
Yeah, I do remember that.
It was really cool. So I was the product.
So you do a search on Expedia, but Sidestep would give you additional, you know, you might look over here and here and here. This is before Kayak and Orbitz and all these other multi-site searches.
Exactly. So Sidestep, I actually was the product manager that launched the website for Sidestep. And we launched about the same time as Kayak did. And then Kayak eventually bought Sidestep many years later.
So is this your first exposure to search?
Yeah, it was my first exposure to search and my first exposure to really deep technology. I mean, with each subsequent company, it's gotten, you know, I've gone deeper down the rabbit hole, which is good.
Yeah.
You know, I realized that it's fun to... Product is a very interesting position. I mean, you sit kind of in marketing, kind of in product, kind of in technology, kind of in business development. You sit in all these places and kind of have to understand what they all do. I think it's why, you know, the traditional training in the Valley used to be you go become a product manager at a chip company for, you know, 10 years, then you become a CEO somewhere.
Right.
And I think still to this day that, you know, a good product manager... I mean, it's the best training out there, far better than an MBA.
What does a product manager do? A product manager is a word like, or two words like, a producer, where you hear it, you know they exist, but you don't know. And then there's flavors. There's product marketing managers. What is a product manager?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the problem, is that it can mean many, many different things. Like, on some hand, you could be a very technical product manager, which I've been before.
So you have a team of developers, and you're leading them, kind of.
You're working with them to figure out how to solve a bunch of problems, internal and external,
right,
technology and otherwise. You're going through a lot of data with them and trying to understand what's going on in the data.
So you're kind of a translator between the engineers and the marketers and the company, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, the quote from Office Space that a product manager is a people person, right? They take the requirements from the customers and hand them to developers.
Right.
I mean, that's a naive view of it, but that essentially is what happens. It's like, what do people want? That's the primary question. A designer asks what makes people happy.
What do you want? Yeah.
The developer says, can we do it? The product manager says, what do people want?
Right.
And it's really those functions, I think, that work together at a company to produce a really awesome product.
Product manager is important, very important. But because you're not physically touching bits, I think sometimes people don't think you're doing anything.
Yeah, no, it's hard to explain to people, especially not in the industry, what the heck a product manager does. But it turns out to be a really integral part of a company. I mean, one of the biggest problems with product managers is there's a lot of bad product managers out there. So, like, finding a really good one is quite difficult, actually.
If a piece of software is bad, can I blame the product manager?
I mean, there's someone to blame, and it might be that person, but she might not to be blamed also. We just don't know.
Might not be her fault.
There's so many problems that can go wrong at a company.
In fact, you often really think that when software is good, and this is actually the case, it's a freak of nature. It is, and that's why when you, I said with the doorbell, when you see something that's good, you kind of know it. It stands head and shoulders above everything else. Is
absolutely.
That true?
I mean, people think that Google was the first search startup. It wasn't. They had a better product.
Right.
And that was key. And there's reasons why they had a better product, but at the end of the day, it worked and it had a super simple interface. I mean, remember Alta Vista? It was a whole mess of glowing ads.
Oh, God. There was a ton of them. In fact, Google came out of, was it go.com, which was an ad-based search? And I think it was almost a response to the fact that people were putting ad results in the search results. And they said, you know, we should really move those outside of that. We shouldn't have it be part of that. And of course, the page rank is a beautiful algorithm.
Yeah.
But it isn't always the best technology that wins, is it?
Oh, well, I mean, rarely does the best technology win. I mean, talk to the Amiga people. Talk to
BOS.
The BOS people.
That's BOS always leaps to
There's
mind.
Another philosopher.
Jean-Louis Gasset. That's what leaps to mind immediately is BOS for some reason, because it was so beautiful, so elegant, and it just never went anywhere. And it had such promise.
Well, when companies come to me and ask about this great product idea they have, the first question I ask them is, what's your distribution strategy? That often I find great products don't figure out how to get it to people, for example. And I think that as you're building a great product and sort of thinking about what that means, I think figuring out how to get it to people actually usually is incorporated within the product. You know, how you tell it, how your customers are going to share it with people.
Like virality is part of the product, isn't it? Getting people and to tell other people about it. If you're an app, for instance, you're swamped in millions of other apps on the App Store. How are you going to get people to find out about it?
I think it was, you know, one of the problems we had at Zeit is we realized that too late on, is that the people who found Zeit thought it was the greatest product ever.
I loved Zeit.
It was a great product.
Used it.
Our retention was off the charts.
But it's getting that.
It's getting those new people
first
in.
First user.
And we, you know, as we were selling it the second time, we had plans to think about Zeit Social. Like, how do you turn this into a more social service?
Should have started with that, huh?
I don't know if we should have started with it, but we should have thought of it much earlier on, for sure.
Let's take a break. Let's talk about Zeit.
Okay.
And I don't understand how you could sell a company twice, but we'll find out in just a second. Mark Johnson is our guest, and I really do want to get to artificial intelligence, because really that's what you're here for. And I think, frankly, going forward, that's the most interesting technology. For years, people in the earliest days of computing talked about AI as if it was going to change everything. Then they talked about AI as if it was a complete failure. And all of a sudden, we're talking about AI again. And I'm curious what's happened there. But we'll do that in just a second. I'm thrilled to have Mark here on the show. And I'm glad you're here watching, aren't you? Our show today brought to you by Braintree. If you're a mobile app developer, one of the things you are probably trying to decide is, how do we get payments in there? And how do we get the payment experience to be stellar for our customers and work for us? And I've got the answer. It's very simple. Braintree, my friends. BraintreePayments.com/triangulation. Their V.0 SDK means you can put mobile payments in your app with 10 lines of code. And, of course, they support all the frameworks, all the languages that everybody uses. They also support all the payment methods your customers want. Apple Pay, PayPal, Venmo, credit cards, even using Coinbase, even Bitcoin, which is wild, right? I mean, you can put Bitcoin in your app. You don't have to, but you can, and I think that's awesome. They also solve a really big problem in mobile payments, and that's shopping cart abandonment. Shopping carts are too complicated. Customers look at them. They're not sure it's safe. They just 70% of all transactions end before they're completed, and they end in the shopping cart. You can fix that with Braintree. And I'll tell you how you know. Uber uses Braintree. What's the secret sauce for Uber? You get where you're going and you get out of the car. You're done. That's Braintree. Airbnb uses Braintree. Hotel Tonight uses Braintree. You know, GitHub, when they started, used Braintree. And Braintree went from them, from their first dollar to their, what is it now, $50 billion? They're a multi-time unicorn thanks to easy, safe, secure payments. And as a company, you'll love the fact that they pay out fast. They have great fraud protection, great customer service. Look at all the companies who use Braintree. It's great when when Uber and Lyft use a company, you know it must be the right company. Braintree, you want to try it? They've got a sandbox. You can see how your app will look with Braintree. They've got great customer service and support for you that'll help you if you have any integration issues. That V.0 SDK is amazing. Try it right now. BraintreePayments.com/triangulation. And if you need a little sweetener, how about this? They're going to give you your first $50,000 in transactions fee free. BraintreePayments.com/triangulation. Go to your product manager and tell her about it. Braintree Payment. And if you're the product manager, you're going to be a hero. BraintreePayments.com/triangulation.
Distribution happening right here.
That's part of it, isn't it? Is making that easy to do.
Definitely.
So these are the things you got to think about with a startup. So tell me how Zeit got started.
So Zeit's interesting. So I actually became an advisor to this company called Wario, which spun technology out of the University of British Columbia in probably 2004 or 5. And they had built this. It was something like if Google, Facebook, and Delicious had a baby, it would be Wario, right? You don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. The customers didn't know what it was.
Whoa.
Right. But they had this incredible technology. So
was it around news initially, or what was the...
It was some sort of search engine that tried to give you personalized results. But it had a lot. It had so many features in it. I mean, talk about product management. Feature creep is one of the worst problems that happens with a product. Is if what you're doing right now doesn't work, just add some more features, right, and that'll be good.
It's hard to build, hard to maintain. It's hard to say what you do, which is obviously one of the problems Zeit has. What is this? What does it do? Well, it does everything, but what, like what?
Make it simple.
Yeah.
So yeah, I went up there August 2000 and I don't know something 2010, and we discussed what we wanted to do in the company.
Recent? It's kind of amazing.
I know. I get confused.
How
by
did
days,
this happen
days.
So fast? Okay, but 2010.
We were like, what do we do? And the trends we saw were that we had this incredible personalization technology that looked at a lot of news articles. Mobile was really, the iPad had just been released.
And it was very clear people were going to start migrating to this mobile platform, right?
Absolutely. Is that a lot of reading was done on iPads, and more and more of this was going to happen. And we just weren't satisfied with the solutions out there, like Google Reader. Just, you subscribe to 1,000 RSS feeds and you're just overwhelmed. How do we get the right news to the right people?
Right.
So we conceived of Zeit, and it launched. I became CEO. And then we launched the same week as the iPad 2 launched, which was
perfect.
Completely fortuitous because we were also top of the iPad store. So we got a boatload of early downloads with Zeit and a lot of really good PR the first day. So we were really happy with that. And then it perked up the ears of media companies who sent us a nasty cease and desist about
really?
2 weeks after we launched. Yeah.
Oh, because you were deep linking into articles? You weren't sending them to the websites? What were you doing wrong?
I don't know if you remember the iPad 1, but it rendered web pages really poorly. Like, it would heat up your lap as Safari was running.
Yeah.
So we stripped out all the extraneous material, which included ads. And, I mean, frankly, it was just a better user experience rather than these non-tablet optimized pages back in 2010. I guess guess this is 2011. So because we stripped out the ads, they weren't happy about it.
Right. Was Flipboard a competitor at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I would say they were primary competitor.
And it was parallel almost. And I remember looking at Flipboard going, they're in trouble. And Zite, too, to a lesser degree. But I thought, they're in trouble because I'm reading all this stuff and I'm never seeing the site. What did you do to respond to these companies? I mean, that's a legitimate concern on their part.
Well, so we had thought that we were going to have, you know, a few 10,000-ish downloads the first month, and then we could go talk to everybody. You know, we had many more than that, so we weren't really prepared
sometimes
for the fame.
Sometimes success is a bad thing.
It is. Although, interestingly enough, so it got leaked to Kara Swisher. Dow Jones was one of the signatories. I mean, this was the who's who of the media world who signed this. Got leaked to Kara Swisher, and Time Inc. was one of the signatories. And my boss, Casey Estenson, who was SVP of CNN Digital, this perked up his ears. He's like, well, Time Inc. doesn't like it, so there must be something
interesting good about
it. Yeah. So he called us up, and at first it was partnership, then it was investment, then it was can we buy you?
Interesting.
And what I convinced them of was that they should run Zite, let me continue to run Zite like a startup within CNN.
But CNN's a television network. Zite is very much about text, isn't it?
Well, so the hope was that the underlying personalization technology, one of the most visited pages on the web back then, I think it's still one of the most visited home pages. It's something 80% of people type into their browser, right? CNN.com, like not Google searches and whatnot.
Yeah.
So the idea was they produce over 200 pieces of content a day. What if they could actually personalize that to what you care about?
It is an issue. I mean, we even have that issue. We don't produce nearly as much content. But what do you put on the web page? How do you give people what they're looking for? How do you solve this navigation issue? You've got a lot of content. And with 200 pieces a day, how do you give people the thing that they would that would make them go, yeah, I want that, as opposed to the thing they go, well, that's boring.
Yeah, there's curation where someone else organizes the articles, like a human being. There's search where you have to know what you're looking for.
Right.
And then there's personalization where it just knows who you are and delivers you the right things. So the idea was that we could use the Zite technology for that. But there was also a belief internally that Zite could become a huge business. So they let me, there was only five people at the time that we got acquired. They actually let me hire a team, so by the time we left, we were 17 people.
So you're kind of autonomous within CNN as almost even a standalone business.
I like to joke that I was the only CEO at CNN because we reported to the president of CNN, so I actually was.
That's pretty funny. So Flipboard's going along. Flipboard solved that problem in a different way. They said, well, we'll just aggregate your Twitter feed. You follow people on Twitter. You've already sent a signal about what you're interested in. We'll just make that a magazine. Zite is doing something different.
Yeah, I think the idea was that's cool, but building that Twitter feed for people
it's a lot of work
for people somebody. Like you that have 500,000 followers, it's much easier. But you know, my mom goes in front of Twitter now; she's got it, but it takes a while to build up the people that you want.
Zuckerberg said nobody wants to make lists.
No one wants to make lists. What you want to do is tell the machine what you're interested in.
Yeah.
That's what Zite did, is that we asked you a list of categories you were interested in and delivered you interesting news.
Right. And
very
then
simple.
It got better over time as you read stuff. What were you watching? What signals were you getting from the user?
So we did look at their Twitter feeds, whom they followed, and what sort of articles they had posted on their Twitter feed were incredibly important. So that's one way we looked at it. And then we would look at both the content of the story and who is sharing that story. So both of those are signals about what someone might want. The content is like, okay, if I read a lot about volcanoes, I probably want to read about volcanoes in the future. But also, it's not just that. Like, the people who are interesting, people like you, probably like things that you like. And
right.
That's the theory behind a recommender engine, is that you can look at that, for example, on Twitter, and figure out people who are similar to you.
Is it a little bittersweet that 5 years later, Apple, Facebook, and a bunch of startups like Nuzzle are trying to do the same thing? You know, I mean, this is, I mean, Apple with its news app, which is not out yet, but will be out in a month or two, claims to be basically Zite. Facebook with its algorithms is they say, you know, the majority of people under 25 get their news from Facebook. So they want to be a news feed. Everybody's doing this.
Yeah, I think, you know, what they say about flattery. but, I mean, the flip side is that, you know, were we too early on the curve? Did we not, you know, talk about our value proposition enough? Because
I'll tell you it was that first thing you talked about, distribution.
Yeah.
People didn't know it existed. You must. You've got millions of. How many users did you have? You must have had millions.
When
of
we
users.
Sold, we were at a million monthly active users.
But see, that's nothing compared to even a page like Engadget with 20 million. I mean, you're not as big as you need to be, really.
Well, but engagement was really high.
I bet it was.
Among those, it's an average person read almost 10 articles a day, just under 10 articles a day. That's incredible engagement for a news app. The average user spent 22 minutes a day on it. So we had really, really good engagement, really good repeat engagement. Basically, if you downloaded Zeit and actually spent a little bit of time with it, you were almost guaranteed to come back.
That's the problem. Getting them to download it and spend a little time with it.
This is the problem with all apps, though, is that it's extremely noisy out there. A good friend of mine jokes that I'm default guy because I don't like changing things too much.
Everybody's default guy. The tyranny of the default. We use that.
And, I just don't download tons of apps anymore because I find that my screens are just cluttered with more and more apps. And there's just got to be a better way. You know, the biggest recommendation problem out there right now, I think, is the iTunes store. It's like, how do they get the App Store to give you better apps that you actually care about?
And they do a terrible job.
Terrible.
Why are recommendation engines so bad? Is that a really hard problem to solve?
It is a really hard problem because getting the data is really hard. So we were lucky at Zeit that we had access to the Twitter fire hose and were grandfathered in. So that's an incredible data set because not only do you know what people are reading, you know whom people are following. And you combine those two things together and you have an extremely rich data set. And that's really what made Zeit powerful is how we looked at that matrix and better understood it.
Twitter must know. I think they do know that they have a real gold nugget in there. How come they haven't been able to use
that?
Do they know?
Twitter. You are sitting on a gold
Twitter?
Mine of information, right?
That
if Twitter were smart, Twitter may not be their core moneymaker in the future. That what they can mine out of Twitter could be the moneymaker.
Huge.
And I'm just surprised they haven't done it yet.
Yeah. Google Plus was created to essentially get those same kind of signals into Google. Mark Zuckerberg's got them, and I think Mark knows what
I think
he's
Mark
got.
Knows. I would agree that they're very smart about the kinds of things, the kinds of features they build in that are supported by a lot of technology. I mean, most people didn't know that Zeit was supported by an incredible amount of technology.
Right.
And we wanted to keep it that way, and I think Mark is really smart in that regard.
Interesting. Why didn't you want anybody to know? They don't need to know.
That's not why someone's coming. They don't care about how it
if
works.
If it works, they'll
know
it works.
They just care that it does work.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. So you sold it to CNN. Doesn't CNN still own it? No.
So at some point, we decided that though it was a great few-year run at CNN, it was time for Zeit to have a new life. That
they weren't really growing it in the way you hoped.
We really needed more investment to keep up with the rest of the news readers out there. So they called me up and said, "Hey, we'd like to sell it again." I was like, "Oh, that makes sense, right?" I'd actually suggested this that either more investment from CNN, outside investment, or a sale made sense. And it was eventually decided that should be the case, and we ran around and sold it successfully to Flipboard.
You're a competitor for 5 years.
Yeah, a competitor, but very complementary skill set. So Flipboard was all about distribution, brand, product, and Zeit had a lot of great underlying technology.
Yeah,
and the combination of those two was thought to be very powerful.
So has Mike McHugh used Zeit well, in your opinion, over there at Flipboard? I mean, I don't even know how Zeit has been incorporated in.
Well,
can you see little bits of Zeit in there?
There are definitely little bits of Zeit, but I know no Zeit user who said, "Wow, Flipboard has really used the technology effectively and created a new Zeit."
Yeah.
So unfortunately, no. That I don't go to Zeit nearly as often as I used to. I mean, after moving to New Mexico, I also gave up tech news. So that's part of it. But I just don't find myself going to Zeit as often as I used to.
Now I'm going to download Zeit and install it again just because I want to, I don't know, for nostalgia's sake, you know?
I mean, there's still things that I'll occasionally find in Zeit where I just couldn't have read elsewhere. I mean, when I look at the compliments that people gave us about Zeit, that was the number one. They said, I find stuff on Zeit that I would have never, ever otherwise
found. So that's
the
goal, is to say, today I read something I would not have read without Zeit.
I think that's good way to look at it is that recommendations are really about serendipity.
Yes.
But it's guided serendipity, right? Like, I don't want something random from the grab bag.
No.
I want to know what my favorite flavors are, and I pull out a chocolate, and I say, okay.
So you want something that's going to ring your chimes, but you don't know what it is. You don't know what's out there. somehow magically this engine has to figure that out based on whatever it's gathered about you. And if it can do that, man, that is valuable. You know, if you can do that, that is valuable. That is really great.
Yeah, and it was really...
Nothing does that very well yet.
No, I mean, that's why it's... You're right that all these companies are trying to do it these days. And, you know, it's... But we talked about Google earlier, right? That
right.
The first product does not always win in a market.
I am probably not the typical customer because my job is to scan tech news. I do it almost... When I'm not on the show, I'm almost constantly... Looking, I use Feedly. I do use Flipboard, but most the one thing that makes Flipboard useful for me is the ability to bookmark an article because what I need to do is get those articles into Delicious or something. Actually, I use Pinboard, something that then our staff can then make a rundown of the show out of. So we're all in that process all day looking for the big story, and I'm not really looking for that nugget. Although, you know, when you came in here. I shared this story with you that was, to me, exactly what you're talking about, something I would have never read, and that I got from Hacker News.
That's what makes Hacker News amazing. That's what made Slashdot amazing, is that a community comes together.
It's powered by people.
It's powered by people that come together with a certain kind of philosophy about the kinds of things they care about.
These are my people.
They're definitely your people. I miss Slashdot. Do you remember Slashdot?
I still use it.
The discussions on... Oh, it still exists?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Who
it's
knew?
It's still there.
Who knew?
And it's kind of the same. You know what's great about
Good.
You know what's great about Hacker News and Slashdot? Unfortunately, Dig died before it could happen. For a while, they were trashed because they were gamed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dig especially just got gamed to hell, and it became useless. It became no good. It was, you know, a list of listicles. I don't want that. And then people abandoned it because it was so horrible. And the geeks got it back. And that happened to Hacker News. I think there might have been some stuff behind the scenes they were doing to get rid of the spam and stuff. But it all of a sudden got good again.
Yeah, it's, you know, tyranny of the crowds, right?
You want a small group.
When you let the PR people come at it, sometimes it can go awry.
Reddit's the same thing. Some subreddits are a great place to find that nugget, right?
Definitely. I mean, I think you see news again there that you would never see otherwise. I mean, you want to know about volcanoes? Probably Reddit's a darn good place to see
right.
a feed of really interesting volcano
yeah,
articles.
Reddit.com/r/volcano. Right?
Because you probably have some people there who scan the news every day.
Exactly.
They know where to go and they get you great news.
But see, that brings up the problem. People do a really good job of this. Computers don't.
Yes. So, I mean, deep learning first came out in the 80s, right? It was terrible. Because we didn't have the computing power, we didn't have the data, and it wasn't called deep learning back then.
Right.
You know, sort of died.
There was a project, I can't remember the name of it, I'm sure you remember, where they were trying to enter everything of all the knowledge of mankind.
Psych.
And by hand.
Oh, my God. Psych is the stupidest project. I mean, go look it up. It's CYC. It's just so dumb, right? It assumes that the way our minds work is that we're just a collection of facts.
Yeah.
Like, duh. That's not how humans work.
But this is an example. There were so many brick walls in artificial intelligence, and we ran up against every single one of them, didn't we?
Yeah, and some of them we didn't really anticipate. So, for example, one of the things that we're leveraging with Descartes Labs is computation next to data. So one of the coolest things we've done is go through a full petabyte of satellite imagery. So the entire Landsat archive from 1972 to today is 900 terabytes, and then MODIS, another satellite, is another 100 terabytes. Super cool. But the problem is, how do you download that? If you wanted to download 900 terabytes here in this office, first of all, you wouldn't be able to stream any video out of here ever.
Ever.
And two, it would take you like a year.
Yeah.
So getting the data close to the computation is something that we didn't really foresee as a problem.
That's a hard thing to
do.
Yeah.
Like, so we did this all in the Google Cloud. We spun up a supercomputer. We crunched through it in 16 hours. And you can only do that because the data was so close to the computation.
It's clear that something has happened because we're all of a sudden deep learning, artificial intelligence is back. We're going to take a break. When we come back, finally we're getting around to the meat of the matter. And
it's all about AI.
I'm really interested. And boy, there's nobody better to talk to than Mark Johnson from Descartes Labs. He's been around the block, and I say that in a good way. And I think he's found some very interesting stuff. We'll talk about it in just a second. First, let me tell you know what? This is actually kind of apropos. You could hire a human to invest for you, and that human would take about 1% to 3% of what you've got under management, plus hidden fees, transaction charges, things like that. And maybe if this human were good, you make money. Maybe not. And it's really quite a crapshoot. There is a better way. If you read, I read, maybe it was in the 90s, a long time ago, a book called A Random Walk Down Wall Street. And I went, boom. You remember that, right?
Yes.
A light went off. OMG, there is a better way. A way that even a computer can do effectively. It's hard for a human to do. Wealthfront has captured that. In fact, one of their managers wrote A Random Walk Down Wall Street. It makes it easy for anybody, you and me, to access world-class long-term investment management. And it starts with a minimum investment of a mere $500. And let me tell you about Wealthfront. It is brilliant. First of all, it costs you so much less than a human manager. You're talking about 0.25% a year, 25 basis points, zero commissions, zero hidden fees. That's it. 0.25%. So if, as an example, you had $30,000 invested, about $5 a month, and that's it. Then that's it. And they're doing things that would be very hard to do, not merely investing your money appropriately, rebalancing it appropriately based on your time frame, your aversion or love of risk, that kind of thing. But they're also doing things like tax loss harvesting and direct indexing. So your after-tax returns are optimized. Now, you can use Wealthfront for any kind of long-term investment. This is not, we're not talking day trading here. This, and if you're a day trader, go ahead and day trade all you want. But if you're smart, you're going to put some aside for long-term investment, whether it's retirement, buying a house, buying a sailboat. You know what I'm going to put money? I can't do it yet because the SEC regulations prohibit me from putting money in Wealthfront. But when I can, as soon as they stop advertising, I can do this. Now, there's a rule. You can't have a customer testimonial in a financial product. So if I were a customer, I couldn't do these ads. But I'm waiting. And I'm going to save up for a trip around the world. That's my goal. That's my goal. Wealthfront.com. You can do it right now. Take advantage of this. In fact, if you go to wealthfront.com/triangulation, you can get a portfolio free, what they would do with your money free. And just walk, you know, that's it. Now, as a little bit of a sweetener here, what we'd like to do is get you a special deal. We always ask our advertisers to do this. They've agreed that they will manage your first $15,000 of investments completely fee-free forever. So, yeah, they're very affordable, 1%, 0.25% a year. But the first $15,000, 0% forever. Wealthfront, just, you know, if you don't believe me, put $500 in right now and just see. Promise, 5 years from now when you go, wow, this really works.
Oops.
You've missed out. You've missed the boat. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. It's the first ad for a product we've ever had that I don't use because I'm not allowed to, and it's driving me nuts. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. Give it a try today.
For compliance purposes, I have to tell you, Wealthfront Incorporated is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is the possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit Wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure.
Our guest, Mark Johnson, is an expert in artificial intelligence. He's a 3.5-time entrepreneur.
So complicated.
Or is it 4 times with 3 companies? Something like that. His current company, Descartes Labs, is using technology. Here we go. Here's a little Pellegrino.
Oh,
will that
thank
be
you.
Is that something
That's
you'd
delightful.
Like?
Thank you.
Yes. A little fizz, a little sparkle to enhance your day.
How appropriate for Napa County.
Well, what else? Would you like
Marine
some
County.
Cheese and a fine Chardonnay? We're in Sonoma, actually.
Oh, geez.
Just to be precise. Descartes Lab, is it all about image recognition, or is there more to this than that?
I mean, teaching computers to see is a really big goal.
It's an interesting subject, isn't it?
I mean, that's the way we look at it. Is the ultimate goal is to teach computers how to see. Now, what we specialize in is kind of cool. We call it exotic imagery. So we see in RGB, right? Like, and a lot of the deep learning projects that are out there say, okay, here's a frying pan with 2 eggs and some bacon in it. Now, don't get me wrong, that's super cool.
Yeah.
Super, super cool.
Well, and there's value to it. I mean, I look at what Google's doing with photos, for instance, and they're automatically classifying my photos and doing kind of a surprisingly good job of it.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes. That's useful.
Super useful. But there's other kinds of imagery out there that have lots of other bands in them, lots of other data associated with it.
And a lot harder, frankly, to do than two fried eggs.
Yeah, right. I can assure you that no human being on the planet can take a single picture and say, that pixel is corn, and that looks really healthy right now. I think it's going to be 151 bushels an acre. That's just not how it works.
My uncle, for many years, worked in the Army and then for the CIA as a satellite image analyst. That's his job, right? They're looking for, let's say, missiles on Cuba.
Correct.
And they're using loops, and they're going through these images that U-2 planes are taking and satellites later are taking.
Definitely. It's you have a whole fleet of these people sitting around drawing boxes around things.
Yep.
But it requires to be something that's human visible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that a human can grok,
right.
And humans can't grok plant health.
Right.
So it limits you to those types of problems. And typically that imagery has to be very high resolution. At 30 meters, you don't see a darn thing most stuff.
Even in the 60s, he said, no, we could read a newspaper over a guy's shoulder. I'm saying, I think that's classified.
I think that's classified. I always love it. I love it when my team clams up about something. So one cool thing about the national labs is not only are they research labs, but they're functional labs for the government. So my team got called on to do all sorts of cool projects, some of which they can tell me.
Wow. And they can't tell you.
No. I don't have a security clearance.
Wow.
That's, yeah.
Couldn't you get one? Wouldn't you like?
Well, maybe. I'm not sure I'm going to subject myself to that.
With the OPM breach, I think it's probably best not to go for one. Just my advice to you.
Right.
So what's so hard? How do you solve this? You said psych was a failure. Throwing data at a computer is not enough, obviously. Or is it?
In some sense, it's always throwing data at the computer, but how good is your data is the real question. So we found that part of the problem with satellite imagery is, again, these are not photos that are human grokkable. There's all sorts of scientific rectification that you need to do to it before you can do any machine learning on it. So clouds, for example, lots and lots of pixels are covered with clouds
right.
in one way or another, whether it's wispy clouds or deep white clouds. You got to get rid of those before you can figure out what's growing on the ground.
And that has to be done computationally with multiple images, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff cannot... you're just looking at so much data.
Yeah.
When you're looking at years and years of data, I mean, terabytes and terabytes of data, that's just too much for a human to comprehend.
We were talking before the show began about President Obama's executive order, which he gave last week to create the world's fastest supercomputer. China's got it now. They have a petabyte computer, and he says, we want to make an exabyte computer. But you're not using supercomputers, which I found fascinating. Why not?
I would say why. That in the Google Cloud, we spun up 30,000 cores and crunched through a petabyte of data in 16 hours.
Wow.
Right? Like,
and cheaply.
Cheaply, extremely cheaply.
And then when
cheaply.
You're done, you turn it off and the bill's done.
The biggest problem with supercomputers is that I think the fastest Tianhe 2
or the
one in China. It's down for most of the time. It's not like it's constantly crunching things. Like, that's one of the really nice things about on-demand computing is that you can get it very cheaply.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we...
This was Amazon. I think Jeff Bezos' insight and Amazon's insight with the Elastic Cloud was, we've got a lot of computers. It's easy to put PC-grade computers online and parallelize them.
Yeah, remember,
you can do it.
Remember Beowulf clusters?
Yes.
That was a really big step forward.
We spent a lot of time figuring out how to get multiple Linux machines to divide up the work, and that's a hard thing to do.
Many six-packs of beer used to go into my Linux network cards. But yeah, like that thought that you can take a bunch of commodity hardware and build something that is extremely powerful... is itself really powerful because Cray is a cool company and they
right.
build cool, crazy supercomputers.
Right.
But the number of applications for cool, crazy supercomputers is extremely limited.
Is the process of writing software for them similar to the process of writing software for these big, massively parallel cloud computers?
I mean, I'm not super familiar in the world of supercomputers.
It's a
because
high
I've,
end.
I've lived in the
right.
commercial commodity computing world for my entire career.
It's still a high-end.
But it's an extremely high-end thing. I mean, the people that are trusted with the keys to these computers are really good programmers because you've got to get max computation out of them.
What languages do you use for Descartes?
We use a lot of Python.
Python?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Now, Google has come out with Go specifically for this kind of concurrency. Would that help you or...?
Maybe. I mean, one great thing about Descartes is... we're not very religious about anything. We're not religious about deep learning. We're not religious about programming languages. That Python works for now, and if something else comes along that seems like it would work,
gets the job done.
But Python seems like it works pretty well for now. There's no really good reason.
It's not known for its speed. It's fast enough.
Fast enough.
Isn't that fascinating?
I mean, you know, there's some C, C++ used also, but a lot of it's just done in Python.
Fascinating.
I mean, it's a great glue language. A lot of people understand it. There's a lot of good reasons to use Python. It's very easy.
Right. You said that one of the reasons Google's cloud worked is because it was near the data. I don't understand that. How is that?
Oh, so Google had the good sense to take the entire Landsat archive. So cool thing about Landsat is they used to not have enough storage on the planet, like in 1972, to store these. So they would download them or whatever they did from the sky and put them on film and then stick them in refrigerators.
No.
True. So it wasn't until the 90s that they digitized the entire archive, but it was sitting on NASA servers where you had to pay, I don't know if it was a couple hundred dollars or $1,000 an image. And of course, it was really slow to download. Again, there's
how big is an image? I mean, it's hundreds of megabytes, thousands. Is it big?
Yeah, the Landsat tile is fairly large. But we don't care anymore because Google had the foresight to take the entire Landsat archive from the first one taken in 1972 to whatever is being downloaded today and put that all in the Google Cloud. So Amazon has put on AWS, I believe it's just Landsat 8, which is nice because that's the most modern sensor, but
it's not the archives.
History is incredibly important. That I think what you do with satellite imagery is see what changes through time. And, you know, if you want to see what changes through time, it's important to have a time archive to do so.
Yeah. Are you putting some of the imagery up? Are you showing any of this stuff? Or is there any demo I can look at?
You know, we haven't really put anything up yet. We're hard at work on our first product. I mean, it's cool because we're making maps out of these images, and eventually we'll have some pretty neat stuff to show. But on the other hand, a lot of what we're doing is making numbers out of these images.
You know, how nothing to see there.
Nothing. Yeah. I mean, unless you like spreadsheets, which your CTO, luckily some people do.
Your CTO, Steve Brumby, and partner too, right? Came from Los Alamos. He was there for 10 years doing exactly this kind of thing, genetic algorithms and heavy-duty, deep stuff.
Yeah, he got his PhD at the University of Melbourne in the mathematical foundations of quantum field theory.
Oh, my God.
I know. He's a real nerd. That's why we get along so well.
Oh, my God.
And then came to the States to do space, but very quickly turned to image analysis. So has worked on lots and lots of cool projects, everything from hurricanes Katrina and Sandy to major forest fires in the Southwest to analyzing satellite imagery after September 11th.
Interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. And for the first 10 years he was at the labs, worked on genetic algorithms to do various kinds of image analysis, and then became PI on the, which is principal investigator on the deep learning project. The theory there was that there's... the human brain is kind of a petaflop scale machine. And at the time, Roadrunner...
It's being generous, but...
maybe yours, but Roadrunner was the fastest computer at the time, and it was a petaflop scale machine. Right. And it was sort of the resurgence of deep learning around 2008, and he convinced the labs that the U.S. government has lots of image analysis problems. Like, think of satellite imagery alone, that... used to look in Cuba, used to look at Eastern Europe. Now the bad guys could be anywhere.
Right.
So you can't have enough people to go look through all the images. Right. So what do you do now? You have to know where to look.
Is there a deal with Los Alamos that a certain amount of what you do has to be around the things the government needs? Or
no, the licensing terms are really... They're perfect for us. They allow us to operate independently, and we get licensed the underlying technology that, you know, now we've begun to create our own IP now.
And I'm sure investors would love you to sell this to commodity markets and brokers and things like that. Is that part of the plan? Or
yeah, obviously someone trading in commodities wants to know.
Would really love to know how soybeans are doing this week. Yeah.
It's all about the supply side, right?
Right.
State of the art right now, I'm not kidding you. There's people in the U.S. who send out surveys and call farmers. Now, we're really good at this. In the U.S., we have the best data on farms out there. We know mushrooms, cattle heads, corn, we know all this to very good accuracy, but still based on these old technologies like the phone. And if you're talking about Brazil or India, I mean, people literally call up farmers and look at weather patterns and whatnot. So we can give them much better data in real time to understand the supply side of the equation.
Hugely valuable.
Hugely valuable. But what I think is interesting is that we start off thinking commodities traders would be interested, and that's true. But crop insurance and reinsurance, the ag industry itself, who wants to better understand it, you know, what's going on, foreign governments trying to build, you know, figure out what the build their own version of a USDA, and the U.S. government trying to figure out what other countries are producing. I mean, food. Food shortages are huge indicators of instability.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Causes as well as
ISIS, Boko Haram. I mean,
just fascinating stuff. One last question.
Yes, sir.
Elon Musk and others have said, "Watch out! We've got to make sure that artificial intelligence." They're all worried about Terminator and Skynet. You're working in this field. Are you worried about these machines becoming? Are you worried about a singularity?
Never mistake a clear view for a short distance is one of my favorite quotes.
I like that. I like that.
And remember Bill Joy back in the late 90s who was worrying about the gray goo because nanotechnology? Look, we're so far away from the challenges of, like, you have to solve a lot of problems before you get flying guns.
But that's why they say, let's now think about this now, perhaps.
But, you know, we don't know what position we're going to be in 30 or 40 years, what other technologies have been developed, where artificial intelligence is at the time. So I think worrying about them now just causes fear in the public and doesn't really do anything to further the dialogue. I think it's sometimes, you know, the detractors of what we do in technology then use that
gives
as...
ammunition.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Really great to talk to you, Mark. Mark Johnson is chairman, co-founder of Descartes Labs. Lots of philosophy jokes flying around at Descartes
Don't put
Labs.
Descartes before the horse.
I compute, therefore I am. Teaching computers to see the world, what a fascinating subject. I'm so glad you could be here with us today.
And, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Like I said, I've heard this show so many times, it's kind of cool to actually see it and be in it.
Jeez, we built this whole studio for nothing. I sometimes think we did.
It's hard to watch you at the gym.
No. You know what? For most shows, it'd be silly. What do you need to watch Triangulation for? It's just two people talking. And yet there is a significant portion, for this show, the people that watch. I think people are visual, and if they can, if it's convenient, they can, they will. On the other hand, you're right. It's mostly convenient to listen because you're driving or you're working out or whatever. I'm glad, however you want to consume it, I'm glad you did. If you want to be here live, you can even, and watch it and be in the chat room. That's every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC at twit.tv/live. We fixed Ustream. I apologize, but I think it's all better
now. I've got a sales deal here. How much do you charge for access to your data? Do you have deals with Monsanto?
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. You can probably find me on the web.
Monsanto would be very interested. Could Monsanto tell if it was their seed that had planted that corn?
That would be very interesting, wouldn't it? Is it Roundup Ready 1 or Roundup Ready 2?
Yeah. All you'd have to do is maybe put some sort of, I don't know, luminescent product in there. And, you know, maybe
that's
corn would glow red.
The GMO people would be just up in arms about that.
Oh, come on. Get a life. Get a life.
Just drink Soylent.
I'm going to live on Soylent. It is, by the way, they say very specifically, this is not non-GMO. Enjoy.
Highly genetically
modified. Highly not non-GMO. Enjoy. I don't think you can buy a non-GMO soybean, probably. Our show is also available on demand after the fact, live, audio, video, any way you want to consume it. Go to twit.tv/TRI. Go to your favorite podcatcher. Search for Triangulation. Better yet, search for Twit. You'll find all of our shows. Subscribe to them all. You'll make me a happy, happy man. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Thanks to our producer, to Jason Howell on the board, and to Karsta Bondi and Tanya Hall put together this show. And pardon me? Is it Jason? It is Jason, yeah. And who put together the show and booked all of these fabulous guests. I think Karsten found Mark. I'm really glad he did, too. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Triangulation. Bye-bye.